photos, failed electrical inventions, soapstone figurines, shrunken skulls, Aboriginal art. On the shelves, medical reference and meditations, certainly, but also the books that now filled the cubbyhole in the bungalow attic, the 18th century poetry that had almost persuaded him he should be a landscape gardener, his third edition Jane Austen, his Eliot and Lawrence and Wilfred Owen, the complete set of Conrad, the priceless 1783 edition of Crabbe's The Village, his Houseman, the autographed copy of Auden's The Dance of Death. For this was the point, surely. He would be a better doctor for having read literature. What deep readings his modified sensibility might make of human suffering, of the self-destructive folly or sheer bad luck that drive men toward ill health. Birth, death, and frailty in between. Rise and fall. This was the doctor's business, and it was literature's too. He was thinking of the 19th century novel. Broad tolerance and the long view, an inconspicuously warm heart and cool judgment. His kind of doctor would be alive to the monstrous patterns of fate and to the vain and comic denial of the inevitable. He would press the enfeebled pulse, hear the expiring breath, feel the fevered hand begin to cool and reflect in the manner that only literature and religion teach on the puniness and nobility of mankind. His footsteps quickened in the still summer evening to the rhythm of his exultant thoughts. Ahead of him, about 100 yards away, was the bridge, and on it, he thought, picked out against the darkness of the road, was a white shape which seemed at first to be part of the pale stone of the parapet. Staring at it dissolved its outlines, but within a few paces it had taken on a vaguely human form. At this distance, he was not able to tell whether it faced away or toward him. It was motionless, and he assumed he was being watched. He tried for a second or two to entertain himself with the idea of a ghost, but he had no belief in the supernatural, not even in the supremely undemanding being that presided over the Norman church in the village. It was a child, he saw now, and therefore it must be Bryony, in the white dress he had seen her wearing earlier in the day. He could see her clearly now, and he raised his hand and called out to her and said, "It's me, Robbie." But still she did not move. As he approached, it occurred to him that it might be preferable for his letter to precede him into the house. Otherwise, he might have to pass it to Cecilia in company, watched perhaps by her mother, who had been rather cool toward him since he came down. Or he might be unable to give the letter to Cecilia at all, because she would be keeping her distance. If Bryony gave it to her, she would have time to read it and reflect in private. The few extra minutes might soften her. "I was wondering if you'd do me a favour," he said as he came up to her. She nodded and waited. "Will you run ahead and give this note to see?" He put the envelope into her hand as he spoke, and she took it without a word. "I'll be there in a few minutes," he started to say, but she had already turned and was running across the bridge. He leaned back against the parapet and took out a cigarette, as he watched her bobbing and receding form fade into the dusk. It was an awkward age in a girl, he thought contentedly. 12. Or was it 13? He lost sight of her for a second or two, then saw her as she crossed the island, highlighted against the darker mass of trees. Then he lost her again. And it was only when she reappeared on the far side of the second bridge and was leaving the drive to take a short cut across the grass that he stood suddenly, seized by horror and absolute certainty. An involuntary, wordless shout left him as he took a few hurried steps along the drive, faltered, ran on, then stopped again, knowing that pursuit was pointless. He could no longer see her as he cupped his hands around his mouth and bellowed Bryony's name. That was pointless too. He stood there, straining his eyes to see her as if that would help. And straining his memory, too, desperate to believe that he was mistaken. But there was no mistake. The handwritten letter he had rested on the open copy of Gray's Anatomy, Splanchnology section, page 1546, The Vagina. The typed page, left by him near the typewriter, was the one he had taken and folded into the envelope. No need for Freudian smart aleckry. The explanation was simple and mechanical. The innocuous letter was lying across figure 1236, with its bold spread and rakish crown of pubic hair, while his obscene draft was on the table within easy reach. He bellowed Bryony's name again, though he knew she must be by the front entrance by now. Sure enough, within seconds, a distant rhombus of ochre light containing her outline widened, paused, then narrowed to nothing as she entered the house and the door was closed behind her. Chapter 9. On two occasions within half an hour, Cecilia stepped out of her bedroom, caught sight of herself in the gilt-frame mirror at the top of the stairs, and immediately dissatisfied, returned to her wardrobe to reconsider. Her first resort was a black crepe de chine dress, which, according to the dressing-table mirror, bestowed by means of clever cutting a certain severity of form. Its air of invulnerability was heightened by the darkness of her eyes. Rather than offset the effect with a string of pearls, she reached in a moment's inspiration for a necklace of pure jet. The lipstick's bow had been perfect at first application. Various tilts of the head to catch perspectives in triptych reassured her that her face was not too long, or not this evening. She was expected in the kitchen on behalf of her mother, and Leon was waiting for her, she knew, in the drawing room. Still, she found time, as she was about to leave, to return to the dressing table and apply her perfume to the points of her elbows, a playful touch in accord with her mood as she closed the door of her bedroom behind her. But the public gaze of the stairway mirror as she hurried toward it revealed a woman on her way to a funeral, an austere, joyless woman, moreover, whose black carapace had affinities with some form of matchbox-dwelling insect. A stag beetle. It was her future self at 85 in Widow's Weeds. She did not linger. She turned on her heel, which was also black, and returned to her room. She was sceptical because she knew the tricks the mind could play. At the same time, her mind was, in every sense, where she was to spend the evening, and she had to be at ease with herself. She stepped out of the black crepe dress where it fell to the floor and stood in her heels and underwear, surveying the possibilities on the wardrobe racks, mindful of the passing minutes. She hated the thought of appearing austere. Relaxed was how she wanted to feel, and at the same time self-contained. Above all, she wanted to look as though she had not given the matter a moment's thought, and that would take time. Downstairs, the knot of impatience would be tightening in the kitchen, while the minutes she was planning to spend alone with her brother were running out. Soon her mother would appear and want to discuss the table placings. Paul Marshall would come down from his room and be in need of company, and then Robbie would be at the door. How was she to think straight? She ran a hand along the few feet of personal history, her brief chronicle of taste. Here were the flapper dresses of her teenage years, ludicrous, limp, sexless things they looked now, and though one bore wine stains and another a burn hole from her first cigarette, she could not bring herself to turn them out. Here was a dress with the first timid hint of shoulder pads, and others followed more assertively, muscular, older sisters throwing off the boyish years, rediscovering waistlines and curves, dropping their hemlines with self-sufficient disregard for the hopes of men. Her latest and best piece, bought to celebrate the end of finals, before she knew about her miserable third, was the figure-hugging dark green bias-cut, backless evening gown with a halter neck. Too dressy to have its first outing at home. She ran her hand further back and brought out a moiré silk dress with a pleated bodice and scalloped hem. A safe choice, since the pink was muted and musty enough for evening wear. The triple mirror thought so too. She changed her shoes, swapped her jet for the pearls, retouched her makeup, rearranged her hair, applied a little perfume to the base of her throat, more of which was now exposed, and was back out in the corridor in less than 15 minutes.
This ends Disc 3. Atonement, Disc 4.
Earlier in the day, she had seen old Hardman going about the house with a wicker basket, replacing electric bulbs. Perhaps there was now a harsher light at the top of the stairs, for she had never had this difficulty with the mirror there before. Even as she approached from a distance of 40 feet, she saw that it was not going to let her pass. The pink was, in fact, innocently pale, the waistline was too high, the dress flared like an 8-year-old's party frock. All it needed was rabbit buttons. As she drew nearer, an irregularity in the surface of the ancient glass foreshortened her image, and she confronted the child of 15 years before. She stopped and experimentally raised her hands to the side of her head and gripped her hair in bunches. This same mirror must have seen her descend the stairs like this on dozens of occasions, on her way to one more friend's afternoon birthday bash. It would not help her state of mind to go down looking like or believing she looked like Shirley Temple. More in resignation than irritation or panic, she returned to her room. There was no confusion in her mind. These two vivid, untrustworthy impressions, her self-doubt, the intrusive visual clarity and eerie differences that had wrapped themselves around the familiar, were no more than continuations, variations of how she had been seeing and feeling all day. Feeling, but not preferring to think. Besides, she knew what she had to do, and she had known it all along. She owned only one outfit that she genuinely liked, and that was the one she should wear. She let the pink dress fall on top of the black, and stepping contemptuously through the pile, reached for the gown, her green, backless, post-finals gown. As she pulled it on, she approved of the firm caress of the bias cut through the silk of her petticoat, and she felt sleekly impregnable, slippery and secure. It was a mermaid who rose to meet her in her own full-length mirror. She left the pearls in place, changed back into the black high-heeled shoes, once more retouched her hair and makeup, forewent another dab of scent, and then, as she opened the door, gave out a shriek of terror. Inches from her was a face and a raised fist. Her immediate, reeling perception was of a radical Picasso-like perspective in which tears, rimmed and bloated eyes, wet lips and raw, unblown nose blended in a crimson moistness of grief. She recovered herself, placed her hands on the bony shoulders, and gently turned the whole body so she could see the left ear. This was Jackson, about to knock on her door. In his other hand, there was a grey sock. As she stepped back, she noticed he was in ironed grey shorts and white shirt, but was otherwise barefoot. "Little fellow, what's the matter?" For the moment, he could not trust himself to speak. Instead, he held up his sock and with it gestured along the corridor. Cecilia leaned out and saw Piero some distance off, also barefoot, also holding a sock and watching. "You've got a sock each, then?" The boy nodded and swallowed, and then at last he was able to say, "Miss Betty says we'll get a smack if we don't go down now and have our tea, but there's only one pair of socks." "And you've been fighting over it." Jackson shook his head emphatically. As she went along the corridor with the boys to their room, first one, then the other, put his hand in hers, and she was surprised to find herself so gratified. She could not help thinking about her dress. "Didn't you ask your sister to help you?"
"She's not talking to us at the moment."
"Why ever not?"
"She hates us."
Their room was a pitiful mess of clothes, wet towels, orange peel, torn-up pieces of a comic arranged around a sheet of paper, upended chairs partly covered by blankets, and the mattresses at a slew. Between the beds was a broad, damp stain on the carpet, in the centre of which lay a bar of soap and damp wads of lavatory paper. One of the curtains hung at a tilt below the pelmet, and though the windows were open, the air was dank, as though exhaled many times. All the drawers in the clothes chest stood open and empty. The impression was of closeted boredom, punctuated by contests and schemes, jumping between the beds, building a camp, half devising a board game, then giving up. No one in the Tallis household was looking after the Quincy twins, and to conceal her guilt, she said brightly, "We'll never find anything with the room in this state." She began restoring order, remaking the beds, kicking off her high heels to mount a chair to fix the curtain, and setting the twins small, achievable tasks. They were obedient to the letter, but they were quiet and hunched as they went about the work, as though it were retribution rather than deliverance, a scolding rather than kindness, she intended. They were ashamed of their room. As she stood on the chair in her clinging dark green dress, watching the bright ginger heads bobbing and bending to their chores, the simple thought came to her how hopeless and terrifying it was for them to be without love, to construct an existence out of nothing in a strange house. With difficulty, for she could not bend her knees very far, she stepped down and sat on the edge of a bed and patted a space on each side of her. However, the boys remained standing, watching her expectantly. She used the faintly sing-song tones of a nursery schoolteacher she had once admired. "We don't need to cry over lost socks, do we?" Pierrot said. "Actually, we prefer to go home." Chastened, she resumed the tones of adult conversation. "That's impossible at the moment. Your mother's in Paris with having a little holiday, and your father's busy in college, so you'll have to be here for a bit. I'm sorry you've been neglected, but you did have a jolly time in the pool." Jackson said, "We wanted to be in the play, and then Bryony walked off and still hasn't come back." "Are you sure?" "Someone else to worry about. Bryony should have returned long ago." This in turn reminded her of the people downstairs waiting. Her mother, the cook, Leon, the visitor, Robbie. Even the warmth of the evening filling the room through the open windows at her back imposed responsibilities. This was the kind of summer's evening one dreamed of all year, and now here it was at last with its heavy fragrance, its burden of pleasures, and she was too distracted by demands and minor distress to respond. But she simply had to. It was wrong not to. It would be paradise outside on the terrace, drinking gin and tonics with Leon. It was hardly her fault that Aunt Hermione had run off with some toad who delivered fireside sermons on the wireless every week. Enough sadness. Cecilia stood up and clapped her hands. "Yes, it's too bad about the play, but there's nothing we can do. Let's find you some socks and get on." A search revealed that the socks they had arrived in were being washed, and that in the obliterating thrill of passion, Aunt Hermione had omitted to pack more than one extra pair. Cecilia went to Bryony's bedroom and rummaged in a drawer for the least girlish design, white, ankle length, with red and green strawberries around the tops. She assumed there would be a fight now for the grey socks, but the opposite was the case. And to avoid further sorrow, she was obliged to return to Bryony's room for another pair. This time she paused to peer out of the window at the dusk and wonder where her sister was. Drowned in the lake, ravished by gypsies, struck by a passing motor car, she thought ritually, a sound principle being that nothing was ever as one imagined it, and this was an efficient means of excluding the worst. Back with the boys, she tidied Jackson's hair with a comb dipped in water from a vase of flowers, holding his chin tightly between forefinger and thumb as she carved across his scalp a fine straight parting. Piero patiently waited his turn, then without a word they ran off downstairs together to face Betty. Cecilia followed at a slow pace, passing the critical mirror with a glance and completely satisfied with what she saw. Or rather, she cared less, for her mood had shifted since being with the twins, and her thoughts had broadened to include a vague resolution which took shape without any particular content and prompted no specific plan. She had to get away. The thought was calming and pleasurable, and not desperate at all. She reached the first floor landing and paused. Downstairs, her mother, guilt-stricken by her absence from the family, would be spreading anxiety and confusion all about her. To this mix must be added the news, if it was the case, that Bryony was missing. Time and worry would be expended before she was found. There would be a phone call from the department to say that Mr. Tallis had to work late and would stay up in town. Leon, who had the pure gift of avoiding responsibility, would not assume his father's role. Nominally, it would pass to Mrs. Tallis, but ultimately the success of the evening would be in Cecilia's care. All this was clear and not worth struggling against. She would not be abandoning herself to a luscious summer's night. There would be no long session with Leon. She would not be walking barefoot across the lawns under the midnight stars. She felt under her hand the black-stained, varnished pine of the banisters, vaguely neo-Gothic, immovably solid and sham. Above her head there hung by three chains a great cast-iron chandelier which had never been lit in her lifetime. One depended instead on a pair of tasseled wall lights shaded by a quarter circle of fake parchment. By their soupy yellow glow, she moved quietly across the landing to look toward her mother's room. The half-open door, the column of light across the corridor carpet, confirmed that Emily Tallis had risen from her daybed. Cecilia returned to the stairs and hesitated again, reluctant to go down. But there was no choice. There was nothing new in the arrangements, and she was not distressed. 2 years ago, her father disappeared into the preparation of mysterious consultation documents for the Home Office. Her mother had always lived in an invalid shadowland. Bryony had always required mothering from her older sister, and Leon had always floated free, and she had always loved him for it. She had not thought it would be so easy to slip into the old roles. Cambridge had changed her fundamentally, and she thought she was immune. No one in her family, however, noticed the transformation in her, and she was not able to resist the power of their habitual expectations. She blamed no one, but she had hung about the house all summer, encouraged by a vague notion she was re-establishing an important connection with her family. But the connections had never been broken, she now saw. And anyway, her parents were absent in their different ways. Bryony was lost to her fantasies, and Leon was in town. Now it was time for her to move on. She needed an adventure. There was an invitation from an uncle and aunt to accompany them to New York. Aunt Hermione was in Paris. She could go to London and find a job. It was what her father expected of her. It was excitement, she felt, not restlessness, and she would not allow this evening to frustrate her. There would be other evenings like this, and to enjoy them she would have to be elsewhere. Animated by this new certainty, choosing the right dress had surely helped, she crossed the hallway, pushed through the baize door, and strode along the checkered tiled corridor to the kitchen. She entered a cloud in which disembodied faces hung at different heights, like studies in an artist's sketchbook, and all eyes were turned down to a display upon the kitchen table, obscured to Cecilia by Betty's broad back. The blurred red glow at ankle level was the coal fire of the double range, whose door was kicked shut just then with a great clang and an irritable shout. The steam rose thickly from a vat of boiling water which no one was attending. The cook's help, Doll, A thin girl from the village with her hair in an austere bun was at the sink making a bad temper clatter scouring the saucepan lids. But she too was half-turned to see what Betty had set upon the table. One of the faces was Emily Tallis's. Another was Danny Hardman's. A third was his father's. Floating above the rest, standing on stools perhaps, were Jackson and Piero, their expressions solemn. Cecilia felt the gaze of the young Hardman on her. She returned it fiercely, and was gratified when he turned away. The labour in the kitchen had been long and hard all day in the heat, and the residue was everywhere. The flagstone floor was slick with the spilt grease of roasted meat and trodden-in peel. Sodden tea towels, tributes to heroic forgotten labours, drooped above the range like decaying regimental banners in church. Nudging Cecilia's shin, an overflowing basket of vegetable trimmings, which Betty would take home to feed her Gloucester old spot, fattening for December. The cook glanced over her shoulder to take in the newcomer, and before she turned away, there was time to see the fury in eyes that cheek fat had narrowed to gelatinous slices. "Take it off!" she yelled. No doubting that the irritation was directed at Mrs. Tallis. Doll sprang from sink to range, skidded and almost slipped, and picked up two rags to drag the cauldron off the heat. The improving visibility revealed Polly, the chambermaid who everyone said was simple and who stayed on late whenever there was a do. Her wide and trusting eyes were also fixed upon the kitchen table. Cecilia moved round behind Betty to see what everyone else could see. A huge blackened tray, recently pulled from the oven, bearing a quantity of roast potatoes that still sizzled mildly. There were perhaps 100 in all, in ragged rows of pale gold, down which Betty's metal spatula dug and scraped and turned. The undersides held a stickier yellow glow, and here and there a gleaming edge was picked out in nacreous brown, and the occasional filigree lacework that blossomed around a ruptured skin. They were, or would be, perfect. The last row was turned, and Betty said, "You want these, ma'am, in a potato salad?" "Exactly so. Cut the burnt bits away, wipe off the fat, put them in the big Tuscan bowl, and give them a good dousing in olive oil, and then..." Emily gestured vaguely toward a display of fruit by the larder door, where there may or may not have been a lemon. Betty addressed the ceiling. "Will you be wanting a Brussels sprout salad?" "Really, Betty?" "A cauliflower gratin salad? A horseradish sauce salad? You're making a great fuss about nothing. A bread and butter pudding salad?" One of the twins snorted. Even as Cecilia guessed what would come next, it began to happen. Betty turned to her, gripped her arm, and made her appeal. "Miss C, it was a roast what was ordered, and we've been at it all day and temperatures above the boiling point of blood." The scene was novel. The spectators were an unusual element. But the dilemma was familiar enough. How to keep the peace and not humiliate her mother. Also, Cecilia had resolved afresh to be with her brother on the terrace. It was therefore important to be with the winning faction and push to a quick conclusion. She took her mother aside, and Betty, who knew the form well enough, ordered everyone back to their business. Emily and Cecilia Tallis stood by the open door that led to the kitchen garden. "Darling, there's a heat wave, and I'm not going to be talked out of a salad." "Emily, I know it's far too hot, but Leon's absolutely dying for one of Betty's roasts. He goes on about them all the time. I heard him boasting about them to Mr. Marshall." "Oh, my God," Emily said. "I'm with you. I don't want a roast. Best thing is to give everyone a choice. Send Polly out to cut some lettuces. There's beetroot in the larder. Betty can do some new potatoes and then let them cool." "Darling, you're right. You know I'd hate to let little Leon down." And so it was resolved, and the roast was saved. With tactful good grace, Betty set Doll to scrubbing new potatoes, and Polly went outside with a knife. As they came away from the kitchen, Emily put on her dark glasses and said, "I'm glad that's settled, because what's really bothering me is Bryony. I know she's upset. She's moping around outside, and I'm going to bring her in." "Good idea. I was worried about her too," Cecilia said. She was not inclined to dissuade her mother from wandering far away from the terrace. The drawing room, which had transfixed Cecilia that morning with its parallelograms of light, was now in gloom, lit by a single lamp near the fireplace. The open French windows framed a greenish sky, and against that, in silhouette at some distance, the familiar head and shoulders of her brother. As she made her way across the room, she heard the tinkle of ice cubes against his glass, and as she stepped out, she smelled the pennyroyal, chamomile and feverfew crushed underfoot, and headier now than in the morning. No one remembered the name or even the appearance of the temporary gardener, who made it his project some years back to plant up the cracks between the paving stones. At the time, no one understood what he had in mind. Perhaps that was why he was sacked. "Sis, I've been out here 40 minutes and I'm half stewed." "Sorry, where's my drink?" On a low wooden table set against the wall of the house was a paraffin globe lamp, and ranged around it a rudimentary bar. At last the gin and tonic was in her hand. She lit a cigarette from his, and they chinked glasses. "I like the frock." "Can you see it? Turn round." "Gorgeous. I'd forgotten about that mole." "How's the bank?" "Dull and perfectly pleasant. We live for the evenings and weekends. When are you going to come?" They wandered off the terrace onto the gravel path between the roses. The Triton Pond rose before them, an inky mass whose complicated outline was honed against a sky turning greener as the light fell. They could hear the trickle of water, and Cecilia thought she could smell it too, silvery and sharp. It may have been the drink in her hand. She said after a pause, "I'm going a little mad here." "Being everyone's mother again. Do you know, there are girls getting all sorts of jobs now, even taking the civil service exams. That would please the old man." "They'd never have me with a third." "Once your life gets going, you'll find that stuff doesn't mean a thing." They reached the fountain and turned to face the house, and remained in silence for a while, leaning against the parapet at the sight of her disgrace. Reckless, ridiculous, and above all shaming. Only time, a prudish veil of hours, prevented her brother from seeing her as she had been. But she had no such protection from Robbie. He had seen her. He would always be able to see her, even as time smoothed out the memory to a barroom tale. She was still irritated with her brother about the invitation, but she needed him. She wanted to share in his freedom. Solicitously, she prompted him to give her his news. In Leon's life, or rather in his account of his life, no one was mean-spirited, no one schemed or lied or betrayed. Everyone was celebrated, at least in some degree, as though it was a cause for wonder that anyone existed at all. He remembered all his friends' best lines. The effect of one of Leon's anecdotes was to make his listener warm to humankind and its failings. Everyone was, at a minimal estimate, a good egg or a decent sort, and motivation was never judged to be at variance with outward show. If there was mystery or contradiction in a friend, Leon took the long view and found a benign explanation. Literature and politics, science and religion did not bore him. They simply had no place in his world, and nor did any matter about which people seriously disagreed. He had taken a degree in law and was happy to have forgotten the whole experience. It was hard to imagine him ever lonely or bored or despondent. His equanimity was bottomless, as was his lack of ambition, and he assumed that everyone else was much like him. Despite all this, his blandness was perfectly tolerable, even soothing. He talked first of his rowing club. He had been stroke for the second eight recently, and though everyone had been kind, he thought he was happier taking the pace from someone else. Likewise, at the bank, there had been mention of promotion, and when nothing came of it, he was somewhat relieved. Then the girls. The actress Mary, who had been so wonderful in Private Lives, had suddenly removed herself without explanation to Glasgow, and no one knew why. He suspected she was tending a dying relative. Francine, who spoke beautiful French and had outraged the world by wearing a monocle, had gone with him to a Gilbert and Sullivan last week, and in the interval they had seen the King, who had seemed to glance in their direction. The sweet, dependable, well-connected Barbara, whom Jack and Emily thought he should marry, had invited him to spend a week at her parents' castle in the Highlands. He thought it would be churlish not to go. Whenever he seemed about to dry up, Cecilia prodded him with another question. Inexplicably, his rent at the Albany had gone down. An old friend had got a girl with a lisp pregnant, had married her and was jolly happy. Another was buying a motorbike. The father of a chum had bought a vacuum cleaner factory and said it was a license to print money. Someone's grandmother was a brave old stick for walking half a mile on a broken leg. As sweet as the evening air, this talk moved through and round her, conjuring a world of good intentions and pleasant outcomes. Shoulder to shoulder, half standing, half sitting, they faced their childhood home, whose architecturally confused medieval references seemed now to be whimsically light-hearted. Their mother's migraine was a comic interlude in a light opera, the sadness of the twins a sentimental extravagance, the incident in the kitchen no more than the merry jostling of lively spirits. When it was her turn to give an account of recent months, it was impossible not to be influenced by Leon's tone, though her version of it came through helplessly as mockery. She ridiculed her own attempts at genealogy. The family tree was wintry and bare as well as rootless. Grandfather Harry Tallis was the son of a farm labourer who for some reason had changed his name from Cartwright and whose birth and marriage were not recorded. As for Clarissa, all those daylight hours curled up on the bed with pins and needles in her arm, it surely proved the case of Paradise Lost in reverse. The heroine became more loathsome as her death-fixated virtue was revealed. Leon nodded and pursed his lips. He would not pretend to know what she was talking about, nor would he interrupt. She gave a farcical hue to her weeks of boredom and solitude, of how she had come to be with the family and make amends for being away, and had found her parents and sister absent in their different ways. Encouraged by her brother's generous near laughter, she attempted comic sketches based on her daily need for more cigarettes, on Bryony tearing down her poster, on the twins outside her room with a sock each, and on their mother's desire for a miracle at the feast, roast potatoes into potato salad. Leon did not take the biblical reference here. There was desperation in all she said, an emptiness at its core, or something excluded or unnamed that made her talk faster and exaggerate with less conviction. The agreeable nullity of Leon's life was a polished artifact, its ease deceptive, its limitations achieved by invisible hard work and the accidents of character, none of which she could hope to rival. She linked her arm with his and squeezed. That was another thing about Leon. Soft and charming in company, but through his jacket his arm had the consistency of tropical hardwood. She felt soft at every level and transparent. He was looking at her fondly. "What's up, C?" "Nothing. Nothing at all." "You really ought to come and stay with me and look around." There was a figure moving about on the terrace, and lights were coming on in the drawing room. Bryony called out to her brother and sister. Leon called back, "We're over here." "We should go in," Cecilia said, and still arm in arm, they began to walk toward the house. As they passed the roses, she wondered if there really was anything she wanted to tell him. Confessing to her behaviour this morning was certainly not possible. "I'd love to come up to town." Even as she said the words, she imagined herself being dragged back, incapable of packing her bag or of making the train. Perhaps she didn't want to go at all, but she repeated herself a little more emphatically. "I'd love to come." Bryony was waiting impatiently on the terrace to greet her brother. Someone addressed her from inside the drawing room, and she spoke over her shoulder in reply. As Cecilia and Leon approached, they heard the voice again. It was their mother trying to be stern. "I'm only saying it one more time. You will go up now and wash and change." With a lingering look in their direction, Bryony moved toward the French windows. There was something in her hand. Leon said, "We could set you up in no time at all." When they stepped into the room, into the light of several lamps, Bryony was still there, still barefoot and in her filthy white dress, and her mother was standing by the door on the far side of the room, smiling indulgently. Leon stretched out his arms and did the comic Cockney voice he reserved for her. "And if it ain't my lil' sis!" As she hurried past, Bryony pushed into Cecilia's hand a piece of paper folded twice, and then she squealed her brother's name and leaped into his embrace. Conscious of her mother watching, Cecilia adopted an expression of amused curiosity as she unfolded the sheet. Commendably, it was a look she was able to maintain as she took in the small block of typewriting and in a glance absorbed it whole. A unit of meaning whose force and colour was derived from the single repeated word. At her elbow, Bryony was telling Leon about the play she had written for him and lamenting her failure to stage it. "The Trials of Arabella," she kept repeating. "The Trials of Arabella." Never had she appeared so animated, so weirdly excited. She still had her arms about his neck and was standing on tiptoe to nuzzle her cheek against his. Initially, a simple phrase chased round and round in Cecilia's thoughts. Of course, of course. How had she not seen it? Everything was explained. The whole day, the weeks before, her childhood, a lifetime. It was clear to her now. Why else take so long to choose a dress, or fight over a vase, or find everything so different, or be unable to leave? What had made her so blind, so obtuse? Many seconds had passed, and it was no longer plausible to be staring fixedly at the sheet of paper. The act of folding it away brought her to an obvious realization. It could not have been sent unsealed. She turned to look at her sister. Leon was saying to her, "How about this? I'm good at voices. You're even better. We'll read it aloud together." Cecilia moved round him into Bryony's view. "Bryony? Bryony, did you read this?" But Bryony, engaged in a shrill response to her brother's suggestion, writhed in his arms and turned her face from her sister and half buried it in Leon's jacket. From across the room, Emily said soothingly, "Calmly now." Again, Cecilia shifted her position so that she was on the other side of her brother. "Where's the envelope?" Bryony turned her face away again and laughed wildly at something Leon was telling her. Then Cecilia was aware of another figure in their presence, at the edge of vision, moving behind her, and when she turned, she confronted Paul Marshall. In one hand he held a silver tray on which stood 5 cocktail glasses, each one half filled with a viscous brown substance. He lifted a glass and presented it to her. "I insist you try it." Chapter 10. The very complexity of her feelings confirmed Bryony in her view that she was entering an arena of adult emotion and dissembling, from which her writing was bound to benefit. What fairy tale ever held so much by way of contradiction? A savage and thoughtless curiosity prompted her to rip the letter from its envelope. She read it in the hall after Polly had let her in. And though the shock of the message vindicated her completely, this did not prevent her from feeling guilty. It was wrong to open people's letters, but it was right. It was essential for her to know everything. She had been delighted to see her brother again, but that did not prevent her from exaggerating her feelings to avoid her sister's accusing question. And afterward, she had only pretended to be eagerly obedient to her mother's command by running up to her room. As well as wanting to escape Cecilia, she needed to be alone to consider Robbie afresh, and to frame the opening paragraph of a story shot through with real life. No more princesses. The scene by the fountain, its air of ugly threat, and at the end, when both had gone their separate ways, the luminous absence shimmering above the wetness on the gravel, all this would have to be reconsidered. With the letter, something elemental, brutal, perhaps even criminal had been introduced, some principle of darkness, and even in her excitement over the possibilities, she did not doubt that her sister was in some way threatened and would need her help. The word. She tried to prevent it sounding in her thoughts, and yet it danced through them obscenely, a typographical demon, juggling vague insinuating anagrams, an uncle and a nut, the Latin for next, an old English king attempting to turn back the tide. Rhyming words took their form from children's books, the smallest pig in the litter, the hounds pursuing the fox, the flat-bottomed boats on the Cam by Grantchester Meadow. Naturally, she had never heard the word spoken, or seen it in print, or come across it in asterisks. No one in her presence had ever referred to the word's existence. And what was more, no one, not even her mother, had ever referred to the existence of that part of her to which, Bryony was certain, the word referred. She had no doubt that that was what it was. The context helped, but more than that, the word was at one with its meaning, and was almost onomatopoeic. The smooth, hollowed, partly enclosed forms of its first three letters were as clear as a set of anatomical drawings. Three figures huddling at the foot of the cross. That the word had been written by a man confessing to an image in his mind, confiding a lonely preoccupation, disgusted her profoundly. She had read the note standing shamelessly in the centre of the entrance hall, immediately sensing the danger contained by such crudity. Something irreducibly human or male threatened the order of their household, and Bryony knew that unless she helped her sister, they would all suffer. It was also clear that she would have to be helped in a delicate, tactful manner. Otherwise, as Bryony knew from experience, Cecilia would turn on her. These thoughts preoccupied her as she washed her hands and face and chose a clean dress. The socks she wanted to wear were not to be found, but she wasted no time in hunting. She put on some others, strapped on her shoes, and sat at her desk. Downstairs they were drinking cocktails, and she would have at least 20 minutes to herself. She could brush her hair on the way out. Outside her open window a cricket was singing. A sheaf of foolscap from her father's office was before her. The desk light threw down its comforting yellow patch. The fountain pen was in her hand. The orderly troop of farm animals lined along the windowsill, and the straight-laced dolls poised in the various rooms of their open-sided mansion, waited for the gem of her first sentence. At that moment, the urge to be writing was stronger than any notion she had of what she might write. What she wanted was to be lost to the unfolding of an irresistible idea, to see the black thread spooling out from the end of her scratchy silver nib and coiling into words. but how to do justice to the changes that had made her into a real writer at last, and to her chaotic swarm of impressions, and to the disgust and fascination she felt. Order must be imposed. She should begin, as she had decided earlier, with a simple account of what she had seen at the fountain. But that episode in the sunlight was not quite so interesting as the dusk, the idle minutes on the bridge lost to daydreaming, and then Robbie appearing in the semi-darkness, calling to her, holding in his hand the little white square that contained the letter that contained the word. And what did the word contain? She wrote, "There was an old lady who swallowed a fly." Surely it was not too childish to say there had to be a story. And this was the story of a man whom everybody liked, but about whom the heroine always had her doubts. And finally, she was able to reveal that he was the incarnation of evil. But wasn't she, that was Bryony the writer, supposed to be so worldly now as to be above such nursery tale ideas as good and evil? There must be some lofty, godlike place from which all people could be judged alike, not pitted against each other, as in some lifelong hockey match, but seen noisily jostling together in all their glorious imperfection. If such a place existed, she was not worthy of it. She could never forgive Robbie his disgusting mind. Trapped between the urge to write a simple diary account of her day's experiences and the ambition to make something greater of them that would be polished, self-contained and obscure, she sat for many minutes frowning at her sheet of paper and its infantile quotation and did not write another word. Action, she thought, she could describe well enough, and she had the hang of dialogue. She could do the woods in winter and the grimness of a castle wall. But how to do feelings? All very well to write, "She felt sad," or describe what a sad person might do, but what of sadness itself? How was that put across so it could be felt in all its lowering immediacy? Even harder was the threat or the confusion of feeling contradictory things. Pen in hand, she stared across the room toward her hard-faced dolls, the estranged companions of a childhood she considered closed. It was a chilly sensation growing up. She would never sit on Emily's or Cecilia's lap again, or only as a joke. 2 summers ago, on her 11th birthday, her parents, brother and sister, and a 5th person she could not remember, had taken her out onto the lawn and tossed her in a blanket 11 times, and then once for luck. Could she trust it now, the hilarious freedom of the upward flight, the blind trust and the kindly grip of adult wrists, when the 5th person could so easily have been Robbie? At the sound of the soft clearing of a female throat, she looked up, startled. It was Lola. She was leaning apologetically into the room, and as soon as their eyes met, she tapped the door gently with her knuckles. "Can I come in?" She came in anyway, her movements somewhat restricted by the blue satin sheath dress she wore. Her hair was loose, and she was barefoot. As she approached, Bryony put away her pen and covered her sentence with the corner of a book. Lola sat herself down on the edge of the bed and blew dramatically through her cheeks. It was as though they had always had a sisterly end-of-day chat. "I've had the most appalling evening." When Bryony was obliged by her cousin's fierce stare to raise an eyebrow, she continued, "The twins have been torturing me." She thought it was a figure of speech until Lola twisted her shoulder to reveal, high on her arm, a long scratch. "How awful!" She held out her wrists. Round each were blotchy bands of chafing. "Chinese burns." "Exactly. I'll get some antiseptic for your arm. I've done all that myself." It was true. The womanly tang of Lola's perfume could not conceal a childish whiff of germaline. The least Bryony could do was to leave her desk and go to sit beside her cousin. "You poor thing!" Bryony's compassion made Lola's eyes fill, and her voice went husky.
Everybody thinks they're angels just because they look alike, but they're little brutes.
She held back a sob, seeming to bite it down with a tremor along her jaw, and then inhaled deeply several times through flared nostrils. Bryony took her hand and thought she could see how one might begin to love Lola. Then she went to her chest of drawers and took out a hanky, unfolded it and gave it to her. Lola was about to use it, but the sight of its gaily printed motif of cowgirls and lariats caused her to give out a gentle hooting sound on a rising note, the kind of noise children make to imitate ghosts. Downstairs the doorbell rang, and moments later, just discernible, the rapid tick of high heels on the tiled floor of the hallway. It would be Robbie, and Cecilia was going to the door herself. Worried that Lola's crying could be heard downstairs, Bryony got to her feet again and pushed the bedroom door closed. Her cousin's distress produced in her a state of restlessness, an agitation that was close to joy. She went back to the bed and put her arm round Lola, who raised her hands to her face and began to cry. That a girl so brittle and domineering should be brought this low by a couple of 9-year-old boys seemed wondrous to Bryony, and it gave her a sense of her own power. It was what lay behind this near-joyful feeling. Perhaps she was not as weak as she always assumed. Finally, you had to measure yourself by other people. There really was nothing else. Every now and then, quite unintentionally, someone taught you something about yourself. At a loss for words, she gently rubbed her cousin's shoulder and reflected that Jackson and Piero alone could not be responsible for such grief. She remembered there was other sorrow in Lola's life. The family home in the north. Bryony imagined streets of blackened mills and grim men trudging to work with sandwiches in tin boxes. The Quincy home was closed up and might never open again. Lola was beginning to recover. Bryony asked softly, "What happened?" The older girl blew her nose and thought for a moment. "I was getting ready for a bath. They came bursting in and pounced on me. They got me down on the floor." At this memory, she paused to fight another rising sob. "But why would they do that?" She took a deep breath and composed herself. She stared unseeingly across the room. "They want to go home. I said they couldn't. They think I'm the one who's keeping them here." The twins, unreasonably venting their frustration on their sister, all this made sense to Bryony. But what was troubling her organized spirit now was the thought that soon the call would come to go downstairs, and her cousin would need to be in possession of herself. "They just don't understand," Bryony said wisely, as she went to the hand basin and filled it with hot water. "They're just little kids who've taken a bad knock." Full of sadness, Lola lowered her head and nodded in such a way that Bryony felt a rush of tenderness for her. She guided Lola to the basin and put a flannel in her hands. And then, from a mixture of motives, a practical need to change the subject, the desire to share a secret and show the older girl that she, too, had worldly experiences, but above all, because she warmed to Lola and wanted to draw her closer, Bryony told her about meeting Robbie on the bridge, and the letter, and how she had opened it, and what was in it. Rather than say the word out loud, which was unthinkable, she spelled it out for her backward. The effect on Lola was gratifying. She raised her dripping face from the basin and let her mouth fall open. Bryony passed her a towel. Some seconds passed while Lola pretended to find her words. She was hamming it up a bit, but that was fine. And so was her hoarse whisper. "Thinking about it all the time?" Bryony nodded and faced away, as though grappling with tragedy. She could learn to be a little more expressive from her cousin, whose turn it now was to put a comforting hand on Brian's shoulder.
How appalling for you! The man's a